Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. California farmers grow over 250 varieties of grains, vegetables, fruits, and nuts. California is known for its rich agriculture, but the state has never had enough water to sustain itself. Today, California cities and farms draw one-third of their water from the ground. And although mining groundwater has been debated for more than a century, California continues this controversial practice, while other states are prone to drought have actually banned it. In his new book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California, today's guest, Mark Arax, describes this conundrum from floods to droughts and how we move water in California from regions where it rains to regions where it doesn't. Mark Arax is an award-winning journalist who writes about California and the West. He's a former staffer at the Los Angeles Times and is the author of four books, including The King of California, which won a California Book Award. His most recent is The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. And Mark Arax joins us from the studios of KFCF in Fresno. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose.
Well, thank you for joining us, Mark. This is a massive, massive book, just over about 500 words. And I have to say, I was just really struck by the last paragraph in the book. I think this says so much about where we are. You write that in your lifetime, California has gone from 14 million people to 40 million people. Nothing will stop the houses. And I, when I read that line, I was thinking about the politicians who always say we need to build, 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 without really talking about what that means, about our infrastructure. So I just wanted to start off with that because it just says so much about where we've been and where we are right now.
You want to start off at the end of the book, huh?
Well, that line.
So this is not a book that was written for water wonks. I saw the story of California as a chance to, you know, to really write literature, and it's a lot of storytelling. And it's biblical in scope. It goes from drought to flood, from wildfire to mudslide. And, you know, California is one of the greatest stories that could ever be told. I mean, can you think of an act of hubris more epic than California? You know, except that we don't call it hubris. We call it a dream. And so it begins in my backyard. With my three apricot trees in the middle of drought. And then it ends with that paragraph that you read, which is, you know, nothing is stopping this machine, this growth machine, whether you look at the suburbia, whether you look at the farm belt. It's growing in a supercharged way. And that is the legacy of the gold rush.
Yeah, and I guess I begin with that because at a time when there's such a heavy debate about where to build, how much to build, where the state is going, climate change, droughts, it just made me kind of stop in my tracks just thinking about how quickly the state has grown over the years.
You know, we have 10 million people of our 40 million living in the wildland urban interface. That means they're living in the path of wildfire. And I've been up in the town of Paradise telling that story. It'll come out in a month or so. And it's a story of, you know, this defiance of our nature, you know, this place. And it raises a lot of questions along the way.
Let's talk a little bit about your background. The book begins with your family's history. Your grandfather was a survivor of the Armenian genocide. It was really interesting to learn that he survived that genocide by hiding in an attic. He was 15 at the time, and he hid there for a year. You write about your grandfather coming to California by ship and train in 1920, partly because he heard how big the grapes were here. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. So my grandfather was hiding in an attic in Constantinople, and he took some books up there with him. And in Constantinople, the Ottoman Turks had to be careful because all the European powers were in that city. And so they really did the genocide in the interior of California. So my grandfather comes down from the attic, and he takes he goes to work at a bookstore. And there are these great Armenian writers there. And he starts writing poetry, and he gets pretty good. And a rich Armenian railroad magnate wants to send him to Paris to go to the Sorbonne. So my grandfather is prepared to go to Paris to the Sorbonne, and then these letters start coming from Fresno, California, from the last patriarch in our family, the only surviving patriarch. And he is basically selling the myth of California to my grandfather. And he's talking about these grapes that hang from the vines like big jade eggs, and how the watermelons are so capacious that when you scoop out the flesh, you can ride down the irrigation canals in them, just float. So my grandfather has this choice, you know, Paris or Fresno, and he takes the California bait and comes west. And 3 days later, my uncle has sent him to a place called Weed Patch, and he's picking potatoes and fruits and vegetables. He becomes a fruit tramp. Hmm.
And your father was born in a vineyard outside of Fresno and became a raisin grower?
That's right. So, you know, back then, if you work 3-4 years in the fields with your family, you can gather enough money to then buy yourself an actual vineyard. And my grandfather did that, and my father was born on that vineyard, and he became a raisin farmer, and then he became a bar owner. And so when I was growing up, he owned the hottest nightclub between San Francisco and L.A. When I was 14, he brought Chuck Berry to duck walk across this tiny little stage that my dad had built in Fresno. Yes.
you grew up right next to the farms and the irrigation canals in Fresno, and I've heard you in different interviews say that you saw the irrigation canals slicing through your towns as a child. And this is something that, you know, a lot of people who live in cities don't really have much experience with.
That's right. Yeah, no. As a kid, you grow up dumb to your place, and there were these irrigation canals that literally knifed right through our neighborhoods. And three doors down from my grandmother's house was a huge one. And she was frightened of water, frightened of these canals, and made me promise that I would never go near them. As a kid, I never asked the central question of our existence, which was, you know, where's that water coming from? Where is it going to? And to whom is it going to? And by what right? And, it wasn't until I grew up that I started wondering about that and actually going out and trying to find an answer.
Now, you traveled the state for this book, and I was looking at the map in the very beginning of the book, and I just was curious about the distance between Mount Shasta and San Diego, and it's about an 11-hour drive. And so, you know, for those of us who live in cities, people travel San Francisco, for example, to Lake Tahoe, pass through big cities. You know, a lot of people, they might go to Yosemite or maybe the Sierras, but a lot of people never visit some of these towns that you visited, especially when we're talking about the breadbasket of the state. What is it like for you to really do so much traveling in this state? What really stands out for you just about the different climates, the different feel of the state?
Well, I was following our system. So you got to look at what we did in California. When I say hubris, I mean that in all the Greek definition of it. We took the edge of a continent, and it's 1,000 miles long, and it's a chunk of earth where, you know, it rains 140 inches in one spot in the north and maybe 3-4 inches in another spot in the south. And so to invent California, we had to invent the grandest system for moving water the world had ever seen. And so I followed that system from the source, Mount Shasta, all the way down to the Imperial Valley. And what we decided to do was we were going to even out the differences. So if you look at, we drew a line around those 1,000 miles and called it one state. But within that one state were maybe 8, 9, 10 states of nature, different ones. Highest mountain, most epic valley, the you know, desert, all those. And so we're going to even out those differences. And that's what we're still dealing with today. It's an impossible task. And that's why we have these water wars that are kind of hard-baked into our culture.
This book, like I said, is over 500 pages, and it's very in-depth. The first one is, part one is Cracks in the Earth, 2014 to 2016. Part two, Fathers of Extraction, 1769 to 1901. Part three, System to the Rescue, 1901 to 1967. How did you decide how to go about structuring this book? Because it weaves between a lot of history, investigation, and narration.
You're right. I take memoir, I take reportage on the land, and then I take this historical excavation and I put it all together. When I initially set out to do it, I was going to do a book just looking at drought, and then drought turned to flood, and then flood turned into what was the system that we built to temper those two tantrums. And so I start in the present day. I literally start in my backyard. Those apricot trees that I have in 2014, they started blooming in January, which is 3-4 weeks before they should have bloomed. And I couldn't figure out what to call this new season. And I make apricot jam every spring, every summer. And so I went out, and those flowers set into little nubs like they usually do. And then come March, April, I went out one day to look at them. And thousands of these little tiny apricots had dropped. They had shed almost in one night. And they were all sitting there at the foot of these trees. And I couldn't figure out what had happened. This had never happened before. So I called up a buddy of mine who was a pistachio grower. And I said, "Brad, you can't believe what happened to my apricots. It was a mass shedding." And he says, "I'm going to pick you up. I'm going to show you what's going on with my pistachios." Now he farms 10,000 acres, and he indulges me, and I'm always comparing my backyard farming to his mega agriculture. But we drive out to his pistachio orchards, and he says, "I want to show you something that I've never seen before." And so a pistachio orchard is an interesting thing. It's one for every 24 females, there's one male, and so he was spanking the pods on these males, the pollen pods, and nothing was coming off. The females were ready, the males weren't. He says, "I've never seen my orchard this out of sync." And I said, "Well, what is it?" And he said a couple words that are never uttered by farmers. He says, "It's global climate change." He says, "We did not have the chilling hours in winter. We did not have a real winter with enough chilling hours to make my trees in my backyard right and to make his orchard right. My apricots needed to know the death of winter to be able to produce fruit in summer. And that's why they shed, and that's why his pistachios were out of sync."
And he said, if it doesn't sleep in the winter, the nut tree, it doesn't come out in spring. This is the friend Brad who was also mining water from the ground to grow his almond trees, right?
That's right. So as we're in that pistachio orchard, I hear the whine of these three-wheelers, and I look out, and these men are riding these three-wheelers, and on the back of them they have this machine that is shooting out male pollen. Artificially produced male pollen, and well, it's produced. It's real pollen, but it's an artificial insemination that was going on a massive scale, and that's how he was taking care of those pistachios and that out of sync. And then we drove on to his almond orchards, and there, the orchards were planted, and just beyond was just desert. And there he was digging these holes nearly 2,000 feet into the earth to bring up enough water to make up for the shortfall that was not coming from the state system or the federal system of water. There are no rivers out in this area where he's farming, so he had to go deep into the earth to find this water. And it was an extraordinary scene. These derricks had been set up almost as if you were in a Texas oil field, and down went these digging machines to carve out this hole that deep into the earth.
You write about how the acres of almonds in California have tripled in a decade. There's now 1.5 million acres. And writing about your friend Brad, this has become very, very lucrative. You write, he has farmed the last decade and a half on the right side of the gamble, watching his almonds and pistachios triple in price. He talks about his success in the manner of pure observation. He says, quote, "I've been pretty fortunate. Who would have ever guessed when I started planting nuts in 1989 that they'd be selling for $4 and $5 a pound?" End quote. You write that at the end of each season, Brad and his investors can net about $30 million. And so, and a lot of this is sold in Asia. Can you just talk about how nut farming has really exploded, just the acres and then also the profits in California?
So when you're on the land here, digging into the dirt, you're seeing how cotton fields 30, 40 years ago, cotton fields that were there for 50, 60 years, suddenly turned into nuts. And you look back at the history of the valley and you see that we are one boom after the other, a boom that turns into a bust. When my grandfather arrives in 1920, the wheat fields of the middle of California have been converted into vineyards and fruit trees, and we have a full-on raisin boom. In 3 years, that raisin boom turns into a raisin bust, and all these farmers go broke. So today, those nut orchards, pistachio and almond, are just another iteration of the land. And they swear that they're not going to get a nut glut, and it will not turn into a nut bust. But I'm not so sure of that, because we're planting and planting. I took a drive in spring from basically Bakersfield all the way to past Sacramento, and the whole route was just white flowers, the white flowers of almonds. So it's very lucrative right now, but not as lucrative as it was 3-4 years ago, because of a trade war, and some of that, the almond that was selling for $4 or $5 a pound is now around $2.50, $3. So all these fluctuations are happening, and the land is being reinvented as we speak.
Do we know, out of 1.5 million acres of almonds, what percentage is actually sold overseas?
About 40% in some years, sometimes more, a little, sometimes less. It's a great deal. The almond is revered in India. It's revered in China. This is why the almond growers are so nervous about, you know, the tantrums of Donald Trump. Hmm. They're wondering if this market is going to be taken away from them. So it's a good deal, and so you can look at that and say that for every box of or a package of almonds that goes overseas, a slug of our water goes with it. So we're in a sense exporting our water to Asia.
And do you know, I remember a couple of years ago, there were lots and lots of stories in various outlets about how much water is used to grow almonds. Do you know the difference between conventional almonds versus organic almonds, how much water is used?
I don't think there's much difference in water between the two. I think it's a little silly to look at food and kind of reduce it to how much water it takes, because you're going to get into trouble whenever you do that. I mean, they were demonizing the almond because it took a gallon of water to grow a single almond. But if you looked at that calculation and applied it to cattle, meat, or even lentils,
right.
you will see that it takes a great deal of water to create agriculture. It just does. And that's why 80% of our captured water in California, 60 to 80%, that the figure changes, goes to agriculture.
Today we are speaking with award-winning journalist Mark Arax about his new book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. Water is a huge issue in California, and we've done a lot of shows about water and the new groundwater law that has passed. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. Speaking of groundwater, you write that as president of the Pleasant Valley Water District, Brad knows that the unremitting pumping of groundwater cannot be maintained forever. We're extracting 8 million acre feet of water a year out of the earth in California, more than twice the amount stored behind Shasta Dam. 1 acre foot, 326,000 gallons, is enough to sustain 2 to 3 suburban families a year. Now, I thought this was interesting. You write that Brad believes that the new groundwater law is necessary to bring sanity to pumping, but he's sure happy its implementation is a decade, if not two, away. And Mark, when we first started doing shows about groundwater, I mean, most people really didn't know much about this. And all of a sudden, we had these headlines that the ground is sinking in California. And people were floored to learn, shocked to learn, that there were no rules around this for so long.
No, they're shocked to learn that because the stereotype is that California is the most regulated state in the country.
Right.
And yet it's taken us 165 years to contemplate. Well, we've contemplated it before, but to actually put into law, regulations that are going to perhaps, I think I'm actually confident of this, they're going to stop the extraction of groundwater. It has to. I was walking along the length of the aqueduct, that concrete river that extends 700 miles down the western length of California. And in huge parts of the aqueduct, so much water had been pumped out of the ground. The land had sunk, just as you described, not by inches, but by feet, and the aqueduct was sinking with it. And so these stretches of the aqueduct, which relies on gravity to send water from the delta all the way up and over the mountain to Southern California, that gravity had been lost. The pools of the aqueduct were standing still, and Californians were spending tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars a year in extra electricity costs to pump that water through those dead spots onto its destination in Southern California.
Wow.
So it's just not sinking the earth, it's sinking all the infrastructure that we built on top of that earth.
And just to give listeners a sense of how much water we're talking about, you write about Brad's new well, and you say that it'll be flowing long before the law clamps down, pouring out at 1,800 gallons a minute. That is a lot of water, enough to keep 41,000 trees producing pistachios from one year to the next.
It is a lot of water, and Brad, but just an example. I mean, he's on the small end of this extraction. Mm. We have farmers going, 2,000 feet deep into the earth, and in one water district alone, during the drought year, they took out 700,000 acre feet of water. That's enough to satisfy the needs of Los Angeles and beyond. So it's an extraordinary amount. And the problem with that extraction is when a flood year comes to refill that aquifer, the aquifer has lost its ability to absorb that water. It has collapsed onto itself. So we have lost the ability to store that water as much as we did. So each time a drought comes, we lose more and more of our capacity to store water.
Today we're speaking with award-winning journalist Mark Arax about his latest book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, it is our One Planet series. Every Monday, we talk about issues related to the environment and the planet. You can find our shows at yourcallradio.org. Over the past couple of weeks, we've done shows about preparing for California wildfires and what officials have learned, mass extinction and climate change, and what is being done to save the bees. We talked about a great new documentary called The Pollinators. Today, we are speaking with award-winning journalist Mark Arax about his new book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. He writes about floods, droughts, how we move water in California from regions where it rains to regions where it usually doesn't rain. And before we get to calls, Mark, we were talking about the groundwater and the new law that has been put in place. I mean, this is going to really make some major, major changes. Based on the interviews and the conversations you had with farmers, they know that this is not sustainable, and yet they want to keep growing their crops, right? So what did you hear? Were there any themes from the farmers about this new law?
Yeah, it's all about the growth ethic. So the farmers of California, when they first began, they took the flow of their backyard rivers, and they took that flow 100% to grow their crops. And they planted those crops in this perfect soil in the alluvial plain. And then in 1920, the year my grandfather arrives in California, we have invented a turbine pump. And this pump allows the farmer now to go beyond the river into the groundwater. And what you see is the footprint of agriculture then goes from that primo land in the alluvial plain to more marginal land. And now we fast forward and we see the advent of drip irrigation. Those are the drip lines that allow farming then to go on to marginal and poor land, land that's even uphill. You know, you couldn't convey water through furrows uphill. But now with drip lines, you can. And so we've seen now the footprint of agriculture go from primo land to marginal land to now poor land. And so what that groundwater law is going to do, it is going to take the poor land where no rivers run through it, where you're relying only on groundwater, and it's going to fallow those acres. We're talking about 6 million acres of farmland in the San Joaquin Valley alone, not Sacramento, that are being farmed today. And when I'm talking to farmers and talking to irrigation district managers and going to, up and down the valley, they're talking about 1.5 million acres that will go out of production. And it'll be 4 to 4.5 million. This is going to be an incredible change.
Wow. And when I asked you about farmers, I was specifically referring to small farmers. But we should really say, what do we mean when we say farmers? Because as you report, hedge fund organizations and investors are coming from Wall Street, for example, and they're buying up a lot of land, which is creating a very different kind of valley. And how big is that? And how are farmers responding to that?
So let me go back to history again, because that's what I do in the book. As I'm weaving present day, I'm weaving history into it because it's so instructive. So we start off in this gold rush, and the mining of gold is really the mining of water first. And then the gold is polluting the rivers, and it's silting up the early farmland. And so we basically shut down the gold mine. The industrialists who made the most money off of gold, they're living on Nob Hill in San Francisco, and they decide that they're not mining gold anymore, they're going to mine the soil. And so they start farming from afar, the middle of California, that great valley. They plant this wheat, and these guys become the greatest wheat growers in the world. They're led by Isaac Friedlander, who is this was an industrialist from the gold rush. A 6'7", 300-pound giant. He has these clipper ships that take his wheat from California all the way to Europe, and they call it their California velvet. It's the most prized wheat in the world. But that monoculture then steals too much fertility from the soil. The wheat fields give way to the fruit fields, the vegetable fields, the nut orchards. That changes the culture of the middle. The small farmer has a chance for a while, but then it goes back into the hands of big agriculture again, so that we have a grower named Stuart Resnick who lives in Beverly Hills, and he's farming 130,000 acres of California from Lost Hills on the other side of the mountain. And he's not just one giant. There are other giants like him. And these giants, for whatever reason, agree to tell their story to me. They've never told it before. And their story is in this book. Now what we see is the next kind of nth degree of that growth. And we see the hedge funds and the pension funds coming in and buying that land. And really they're buying it for the water.
You actually got an interview with Stuart Resnick and his wife, Linda Resnick, right?
Oh, I got many interviews with them. I spent 10 years basically gathering the story of Stuart and Linda Resnick. It's a remarkable story.
It really is. You know, I want to go into that, but at first we have a number of people on the line, and I don't want to have them wait too long. So why don't we take a few callers, and then we'll talk about the Resnicks. Today we are speaking with award-winning journalist Mark Arax, author of The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. Let's hear from Richard in Berkeley. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I have heard that the fracking that is being done in California, the used fracking water liquid is being pumped back down into the ground, and that most of these casings eventually crack and this used fracking water seeps into the ground. And I've heard that it is threatening some of our pristine aquifers. And once it pollutes those aquifers with benzene and all these other terrible chemicals, that aquifer is lost forever. Do you know anything about that? Is that true?
Oh, yes. Yeah, that is true. You're seeing right now farmers getting very concerned because, they don't want to put the byproducts of fracking onto their fields. You're seeing some agriculture using the byproduct of fracking to grow maybe cotton or something that isn't consumed by us, but you're not seeing it used on crops. So there's this strange thing that's playing out on the land right now. How much of that land is going to be fracked? Can fracking keep its pollutants from infiltrating the rest of the aquifer? Will agriculture rise up and actually go to war against oil? You know, the big ag and big oil are the two huge forces in Kern County, for instance. They've gone to war in the past over these issues of resources, and the question is, will they go to war again? So yeah, that is playing out right now, and it's adding to all the other issues and complexities that are playing out.
Well, thank you for the call, Richard. Let's go next to Stephen in San Francisco. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is simply, I know about these things called injection wells, and I wondered if a program of injection wells could feasibly mitigate the groundwater depletion problem.
I don't know about injection wells mitigating such a huge extraction of water. I really think SGMA, the State Groundwater Management Act, is going to go a long ways to bringing sanity again to that issue. You're seeing farmers now meeting with other farmers in deciding what is sustainable in terms of water use. I think that much more than technology and injection wells is going to save us. We keep waiting for technology to come along and save us from the consequences of our extraction culture, and I just don't think it's going to happen. I think we're going to have to do something that we've never done before, and that is actually contract, make smaller the footprint of agriculture. And then, I spend as much time asking that question as I do about the march of suburbia across the desert. Mm. Will the water that we save through the Groundwater Sustainability Act, will that then be sold by the farmer and go up and over the mountain to pave over more of the desert? Will it go to the developers of the Central Valley to then turn this valley into a San Fernando Valley, pave it over it as well? So these are the questions that we're looking at. These are the kind of cracks into the system, the cracks of the system that I go into to try to figure out where we were and where we're headed.
Well, thank you for calling in, Stephen. Let's hear next from Stu in San Francisco. Hi, Stu.
Yeah, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to get the author's thoughts on how he thinks, the recent abandonment of the lease of Scott's Dam by PG&E is going to affect the Pillsbury Reservoir and the diversion of Eel River water into the Russian River. It sounds like there's a decent possibility that the dam will come down. I understand it would cost $50 million to build the required fish ladder, but $35 million to bring down the dam. So I'd love to hear what the author thinks and how he thinks it might get worked out.
You know, I don't know much about that issue. I was on the land with a gentleman named Richard Wilson, who is was a rancher conservationist who actually defeated almost single-handedly the damming of the Eel River. And it would have flooded out his entire valley where he was living and growing his alfalfa and everything else. I haven't kept up with PG&E's plan on that. What I do know is that we shouldn't be talking about building dams, concrete dams anymore. It doesn't make sense, especially when we're with the swings between drought and flood are the way they are inherently in this state, and how they're going to become even more wild as climate change hitches on to our inherent tantrums. The answer, I think, is instead of upstream dam building, we do downstream water banking. There are actually, you can park in the ground, you know, millions of acre feet of water that you capture in flood years, and then you could draw upon that water in drought years. So I apologize for not being as knowledgeable as you are on that backyard issue there.
Well, thank you for calling in, Stu. We have a couple emails, Mark. Philip writes, "Forgive my ignorance, but if they can pump shale oil from Canada to Louisiana, can they not also pump water from the East and Midwest where they have too much to the West where we have too little?"
Oh, I've heard farmers talk about, bringing water in from Alaska. I guess it can be done, but it's just all you're doing is avoiding this question of California. How big can we get here? 11 million to 40 million in 60 years. They're talking about building a whole bunch more affordable houses, and yet into what safe zone are we going to put those people? Are we going to put them in the wildland urban interface where 8 to 10 million already live? These are questions that we just keep trying to avoid answering in California. And so it's not enough to extract our own resources. We're going to go to other states to bring their water. I don't think that's going to work.
Well, I was going to ask you that, Mark, because here in the Bay Area, there's a pretty simplistic conversation around housing, and I shouldn't say simplistic, but it's a very simple debate between the YIMBYs, yes in my backyard, versus the NIMBYs, no, yeah, in my backyard, and that's kind of where it ends. What other questions do you think need to be brought into those conversations about unlimited growth and affordable housing?
You ask a very, very good question that we're dealing with this thing in a vacuum. We're not looking at the resource and how much we can spread it out. One of the residents of a city that I was visiting was talking about how he was more than happy to conserve as much water as the city officials were asking him to conserve. But what was upsetting him is that that water truly wasn't being conserved. It was simply whatever he wasn't using was being banked by the city to then give to a new town on the fringe of his city. So conservation in that kind of atmosphere is never conservation. It's just simply fueling the suburb on the fringe of town. And this is what we're not looking at. So as we're talking about bringing hundreds of thousands of affordable houses to California and millions of more people, well, where's the water coming from?
Right.
That's not addressed.
Yeah, very important question. Today we're speaking with award-winning journalist Mark Arax about his new book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. We have another email from a listener who says, do almonds really use so much water, or is it because they have more money to drill farther down and take their neighbor's water?
They're not taking their neighbor's water. They're taking the water underneath them. Is it their water? It's all of our water. But no, I think the almond is taking a gallon of water for each nut. If you want to demonize a crop, I think the easiest one to demonize is alfalfa, because alfalfa, you're using a lot more water than you are on almonds, and it's going to feed Holsteins. And the question becomes is, should we really be having these mega dairies in a state like California, where the water and land are worth so much? And that's a debate that's happening now, this idea that the dairy, which came up and over the mountain from Los Angeles and planted itself in the San Joaquin Valley, will it now go beyond the borders of California, go to places like Colorado and New Mexico, where you can arguably raise more happy cows there? The weather isn't so hot, and the resources that are required to make milk aren't so valuable.
Well, thanks for that email. Let's go next to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I have a question, a couple of things. One, clearly growth is not going to stop in California. There's going to be more people coming, and global warming is going to continue to occur, and we're going to continue to have these problems. So I'm not sure what the source of water is, but I'm wondering at some point desalinization may be an affordable option, and I'd like to find out what your guest thinks about that.
Yes. We mothballed some desal plants in Santa Barbara a decade or so ago. They've been unmothballed, and I think if it's true, if we can't somehow control population and growth, and we go from 40 million to 60 million to 80 million, and farming is paved over, and that water has gone to the various places to house those people, at some point, desal is going to become a real option. It's got its environmental consequences. It's expensive water. But you're right. As that calculation changes, desal will become more and more, something that's viable.
And this is the process of removing salt from water, so it's actually drinkable?
Yeah, it's taking water right out of the ocean and removing the salt and making it potable water. So it sounds easy, and we do have the technology, but it's a massive, massive operation that affects ocean and obviously costs a tremendous amount in electricity. So it's got its own carbon issues.
According to the International Desalination Association, more than 300 million people get their water from desalination plants globally.
That's right. I didn't know it was that many. But you're going to see as things get more and more crazy, in maybe 3-4 generations from now, you're going to see these issues. We're going to have to deal with them in a different way. It's I think desal is not only part of our future, it's happening right now.
Well, thank you for calling in, Greg. Mark, the hour just went by so fast. We have about 5 minutes left, and we're going to have you back because we don't have enough time to really get into the Resnick's part of your book. But I do want to touch on this. And we've done other shows about this also on water issues. So Stuart Resnick is the richest farmer in the United States. You refer to him as the Nut King and his wife as the Pomegranate Queen. People know them possibly.
The Pomegranate Princess.
Sorry about that.
Yes.
They know
that's how she refers to herself.
They know them from the owners of the wonderful company. And you wrote about him in an excerpt from your book that was published in the California Sunday Magazine last year. You won an award for that. And you write, the more water the farmers got, the more crops he planted, and the more crops he planted, the more water he needed to plant more crops, and on and on and on. Since Stuart Resnick has started getting more attention and more people in California are reading about him and knowing just, you know, what he does, more about his empire, has he changed any of his practices?
He's gotten bigger. He pulled out some, considerable amount of orchards during the drought to survive it. He also found a way to build a secret pipeline that was taking groundwater from three counties away and moving it in a very stealth manner across the old Tulare Lake Basin into his orchards. But since the rain has returned, he's growing more, and now he's growing in places that are even beyond his old footprint. So and he's a very complicated story, he and his wife. I mean, they're giving philanthropy back to farmers, farm workers, farm worker communities in a way that's never been done. So I spend 70-80 pages in the book just trying to come to terms with what they're doing. And it's a very complex portrait. That's one thing I try to do in this book, is I'm painting these stories, and I'm trying not to do it in a way that that looks at folks as cardboard cutouts. It's one thing to demonize someone from afar, but when you're on the land with them, they become much more complicated, if not compelling.
I also wanted to ask you about the sections you have on your book, in your book, about Native Americans, because I cringe when people talk about the gold rush and there's hardly any talk about Native Americans.
That's right.
When the gold rush comes up. And so I have to say, when I first saw the title of your book, I thought, oh, I hope Mark Arax includes information about Native Americans. And of course you do. What did you hope to accomplish by including information about Native Americans in the book? Because you write about, what we're taught, what people are taught in school in California, what you were taught. And you did a fair bit of research about tribes in California. And we should also say that Governor Gavin Newsom apologized for Native genocide just a couple of weeks ago in California.
That's right. When you look at the taking of the resources of California, it begins with the taking of the body of the native. It was that taking that allowed for the first taking of the rivers and the water. So the first resource that was extracted in California was the body of the native. And so how can you tell this story of extraction and trace it back to its roots without dealing with the largest concentration of indigenous in North America and how they were wiped out? And it was a genocide. There's a monumental book called by Benjamin Madley, a UCLA professor, on this, and I do my own research into it, and it was a genocide in what it accomplished. I mean, those 300,000 people were wiped out, not in one act, but thousands of acts that took place over a half century.
Well, my grandmother was a California native, Mark, so I just have to say thank you for including it. It feels odd to say thank you, but unfortunately it's missing in so many books about the history of California. So, thank you.
Well, you're welcome.
Well, Mark, we'd love to have you back. We have so many other questions we'd love to ask you. And, I mean, water is just such a huge topic, and we got a lot of calls. So we hope we can have you back soon.
I'd love to be back. This piece on paradise is coming out. It'll deal with all of that. Not on the flatland. Now we're going to be moving up into the mountain and seeing what we've done up there.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for all your great work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose, very much.
Mark Arax is an award-winning journalist and author of the book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. And you can find information about Mark's book and his pieces at yourcallradio.org. Your Call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. If you have a show idea, a guest idea, or feedback, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. You can find our past shows and sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show, and she also started doing our social media today. And thanks to Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.